This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. On the program this afternoon, a conversation with award-winning architect and interior designer Sarah Susanka. She believes how we value houses needs to be recalibrated. The author of The Not-So-Big House, she says, if we could learn more from how we live in a cabin, we'd be much more comfortable in our houses. That first book, The Not-So-Big House, was seen as revolutionary. The books that have followed, including Creating the Not-So-Big House and Not-So-Big Solutions, continued the exploration of the not-so-big. The books have been bestsellers and are tremendously popular among library patrons. You may have to reserve them and return them without renewal because someone else is waiting to take them home. Her latest book, Sarah Susanka's latest book, is Home by Design, Transforming Your House into Home. This book demonstrates design concepts you can use to help make your home inviting and comfortable, no matter its size. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments about homes for Sarah Susanka. Join us with the telephone call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Sarah Susanka's honors include being named a top newsmaker by Newsweek and a U.S. News & World Report innovator. Her books, including the latest, Home by Design, Transforming Your House into Home, are published by the Taunton Press. And you'll find her online at notsobighouse.com. Sarah Susanka, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, it's delightful to be here, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
Sure. When did you get interested in architecture and design? When did that interest begin?
Oh, boy, I was pretty little, actually. I don't think I knew it was called architecture at the time, but I used to, as a kid, love drawing house plans. So that was my earliest inspiration. And I moved from England to California when I was 14 years old, and that had a really pivotal, a really key moment in my life because I started to look at how Americans used their houses and realized that although we spoke the same language, we used very, very different ways of living, and yet the floor plans, surprisingly, were fairly similar. So it right away started me wondering, you know, for example, in this country, why we build so many formal spaces when we really don't use them very frequently, whereas in England, we use them all the time.
Yeah. Well, in this country, I believe that that is changing or is beginning to change because we don't have the formal living room so much anymore and a formal dining room, places that nobody, you know, uses.
That's right.
There was an ad on television. I don't remember what it was for. I think it was for some food product, but I remember the punchline was, "Oh, so this is the dining room." They were having something very special, so then they went into the dining room.
That's right. Yeah, and it's, you know, it's still very frequent though that, you know, people, when you first ask them what they want in their house, will start off with just this, you know, it's almost like something we learn by rote as children. Well, the formal living room, formal dining room, and then when you stop and ask them, you know, when do you use those rooms, they have to stop for a second and go, well, I guess we don't use them anymore. You know, obviously there are people who do, but for those of us who don't, it seems a little silly to be spending, you know, sometimes as much as $100,000 of our budget on those spaces.
Wow. I really like this idea that we could learn a lot from how we live in a cabin or a cottage. That is brilliant, I think.
Yeah, well, it's really, you know, the way that I came to that, I used to have a firm in Minneapolis-St. Paul area, And we had so many of our clients come and tell us basically about how they lived their lives. And it was really obvious that we live so much more informally. And really what they were describing as what they needed on an everyday basis was exactly what we use in a, you know, a second home or a cabin or a cottage. And so we started recognizing that there's really a need for a different way of, you know, sort of packaging how we think about house. And this notion of a smaller, better designed home for everyday living, which is really what we might otherwise call a cabin or a cottage, was exactly what the doctor ordered for an awful lot of people.
Yeah.
So a little smaller, a little more intimate, much more relaxed, so you can let down more easily when you get home from work, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean cramped either.
No, and I really try to help people understand when they hear that, you know, I've written books called The Not So Big House, for example, that I'm not talking about small. I'm talking about not as big as you thought you needed, but actually feeling more spacious and allowing you to live in more of the square footage every day. So, you know, I actually, when I lived in Minneapolis and St. Paul area, built a house for myself that was about 940 square feet on the main level. And so that constituted the living area, dining area, kitchen, and entryway. And I lived in more square footage, basically, because I was living in all of that area every day, and I could see it one place from another very easily.
Mm.
It was actually bigger than most people live in.
Yeah.
So it's confusing to our minds, but it really, truly does work that way if you're just building space that you use
yeah.
all the time.
I have been in a couple of homes that were converted from one from a one-room schoolhouse and another from a small church.
Mm-hmm.
Amazingly wonderful
yes.
homes.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, one of the things that architects really enjoy doing is taking something that had a different purpose and making it a house, because you end up with these wonderful spaces and a lot of charm and a lot of extra character that you wouldn't probably design into a new house, but because you're remodeling and it's there, why not?
Mm. No matter the space we live in, be it house, apartment, mm-hmm. condominium, large or small, how do we open our eyes to what it has and what it lacks, and how can we make it better?
Well, that's really the premise of my new book. Home by Design is really a tool to help people understand what potentials their house has or their dwelling place. We have an awful lot of things that we respond to physiologically as human beings. And architects use this stuff all the time. And I actually refer to this as the architect's toolbox in my new book. So I talk about, for example, developing a sequence of places rather than thinking of a set of rooms to just help us open up our thinking. I talk about ceiling height variety. I talk about light to walk towards, about all these things that we can engage so that we get more excited, more our house feels more vital. And there's many, many ways that we can do this, and you don't need a degree in architecture to be able to implement them. So I just figured I'd write them down so that anybody can start to use them.
I like that word vital and vitality. Mm-hmm. These are words that you use in the book.
Yeah.
Talk with us further about that concept.
Well, sure. Well, you know, when something engages us, wherever you are, you know, let's say that we're looking at a view, we're out driving around and we come to a beautiful spot in the countryside which just makes us want to look more, you feel engaged and you feel more vital. And in just the same way, our houses can do the same thing. So if you design, for example, the interior views, the views from one place to another, so that they look beautiful as you're looking towards them, that makes you feel better. It makes you feel more engaged in the house. And as a consequence, it actually gives you a sense of well-being. And I think we really underestimate how important that quality is in our lives, that the places that we are in all day, every day, can be designed to be inspirational. And, you know, by that I just mean make you feel good. And that has a huge impact on our whole quality of life.
Yeah. In the architect's toolbox, space, light, and order.
Mm-hmm. Those are the big, broad categories that all of these things fit within.
You want to talk?
Sure.
Talk about those with us?
Yes, absolutely. Well, basically, space, light, and order are the overarching principles. So I have in the book about 12 spatial principles, 12, or I think actually there's 10 light principles and about 10 order principles, so that you can look at, let's give an example of a space one so that you get a sense of what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
One that I frequently discuss is ceiling height variety. Now, ceiling height creates a different sense of space. If you've got a lower ceiling, you have a different quality and character to that space than if you've got a tall ceiling. And so what I talk about is that rather than our constantly focusing on taller and taller and taller ceilings, which we tend to do in our culture today, what we really respond to is difference. So if we have a variety of ceiling heights, then we can, if we want to feel more enclosed, we can go to a space that has a lower ceiling and maybe is a little alcove off of a larger room, which gives us that sense of comfort. If we feel like being more public, we can go into a space that has a taller ceiling and maybe has more activities happening within it. The ceiling height designates it's a more important space in the house. And so you can sculpt the third dimension, the heights of everything in the house, which is something that really doesn't happen very frequently in most houses. You either have all the ceilings the same height, or you've got a few rooms that have these big, tall, vaulting ceilings in many newer houses. But there's so much more you can do. So ceiling height variety is an example of a spatial principle. And others that I talk about in the book are changes in level. You can do the same thing with floor. We can talk about openability. We can talk about depth and thickness, which we have a lot of positive experience with. I know a lot of listeners to NPR stations are avid collectors of books.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's wonderful about bookshelves is that they give the wall an automatic depth, which if we think about older houses that we've seen in European cultures, for example, we love that sense of depth of the wall. Well, the bookshelf essentially gives you the same thing without having to build out of stone.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, there's lots of these things that are so easily implementable, but because we don't have names for them, we don't tend to use them. And so what I've really tried to do is just give some labels. And these, although architects use this stuff all the time, they don't actually necessarily refer to them by the same labels that I have. So if you hire an architect and you're wondering why they don't use the same vocabulary that I do, don't worry. They know what the idea is, and you can point them to the chapter and they'll get it right away.
Yeah. One of the wonderful spatial principles that I learned about mm-hmm. by looking at this book, Home by Design, your latest book, is the idea of layering. I never had a word for it.
Isn't it a great one? Let me see if I can try for your listeners to explain what layering is. I think I say in this book that for years I was very frustrated because I was trying to help my clients understand that there's a very important function that is this thing we call layering, that allows you to perceive more there, more in front of you than there actually is. So, for example, if you have a wall, that's a layer that you can't see through. But if you open it up a little bit, so maybe you create a framed opening in that wall, now you are able to look through that layer, but you still see the edges of it, the framed opening and the wall to either side. So by creating these layers through a space and being able to see from one place to the next, it gives you visual information. Just like the analogy I use in the book is that it's just like putting punctuation in a sentence. If we've got a run-on sentence with no commas in it, it's very difficult to get the meaning out of the sentence. But if you've got the commas there, your eye understands that's one phrase, that's another, and so you understand the meaning better. And these layers of information that we can give visually in architecture, again, allow a space to be more intelligible and also surprisingly, to seem bigger because we see more there. Mm. So it's one of these things, it's actually a trick when you've got a small space. You can add a few layers, and in the book I describe all sorts of ways you can do that so that you can make it seem bigger than it actually is.
Yeah. I also like the way you get at this concept a little bit at the very outset of Home by Design when you talk about, let's say, your youngster, your toddler, is looking forward to having some toast this morning. And if you cut the toast on the diagonal twice...
That's it. You end up with four pieces of toast.
And he or she is much happier.
I remember that so vividly. My father used to say, well, how many pieces of toast would you like this morning? And it's the same thing. It looks like more. And just as with a layer, you create more layers and it looks like more. It's exactly the same.
And something else that by getting my brain around this principle of layering, you know, I'm in a house now, and I'm not going to be able to change the ceilings per se. But through other things, I can layer.
Yes.
With lighting fixtures.
Yep.
With what else?
Well,
window
you can
treatments.
Do all sorts of things. Let me give you some examples, some of which are appropriate for an apartment and some of which are more for a house. Now, if you're in an apartment where you really have very limited ability to make separations, you know, the landlord doesn't want you to, you know, do too much to the walls or the ceiling, you can use either sometimes will use a Venetian blind that you actually attach to the ceiling that you can lower, and it can create a layer between one side of the room and the other. So you can open the Venetian blind so that you can see through it, and suddenly you have two rooms, but you're visually connected. Or you can pull the blind up completely, you have it completely open. Or you can actually close the blind completely, and you have two separate rooms. So there's a layer that allows you to do multiple things very flexibly. And, you know, if you move and you have to take it down, you just patch the ceiling and... off you go. So there's an example of a very flexible layer that allows for many different levels of privacy and publicness.
Mm.
On a more built version, one of the things that architects often enjoy doing is using maybe glass or what we think of as an interior window, where you're actually placing what we would normally think of to separate an inside from an outside space, but use it on the inside instead. So perhaps create a partial wall with a glass panel above it. You may have seen this, for example, in a restaurant. Sometimes they do this. But you can do it in your house just as well. And it allows you to then divide perhaps an eating area from a main living space, but without it being too solid, so you still have a sense of participation with the space beyond.
Mm. One of the places that I've lived in over the years, one of my favorite places, it was a little run down, but I was renting an apartment in an older home, and it had lots of wonderful woodwork, and it had pocket doors.
Yes,
so,
they are great.
And, you know, I don't know that I've seen pocket doors in newer homes.
You know, a funny thing happened with pocket doors. Back when ranch houses were all the rage from probably the 40s to the 60s, pocket doors got a bad name because they ended up being, they were usually hollow corridors, so very flimsy, with even flimsier hardware, so that the way that they rolled in and out of the wall was very loose and didn't feel very substantial.
Mm-hmm.
And so people associated those two qualities, the flimsiness and the fact that they would often break down, with the pocket door. In fact, there's nothing wrong with pocket doors at all. If they've got the right hardware and if they're a heavier door, they feel wonderful, just like in the older home you're describing. But I'm trying to help people to understand that pocket doors are a wonderful, wonderful invention because they don't take up floor space when they're open, but when they're closed, they're just as good as a regular solid door.
Yeah.
So
Well, the house that I grew up in was a ranch home. Mm-hmm. My parents built it after the in the 1950s, mm-hmm. or excuse me, late 1950s, yeah. I guess it would have been. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the pocket doors were flimsy, and they separated yep. the kitchen from the rest of the house. But right. in this house, the pocket doors were solid.
Right.
And oh,
yeah,
what a
wonderful
thing!
You just had
thing.
A real feeling of it's almost like majestic in a certain way with many of those older homes, because the doors were heavy, they were wider than usual, and they often met in the middle of a big wide arched opening
uh-huh.
or framed opening, and yeah, they were wonderful.
Yeah, we have a listener who would like to talk with you this afternoon, Sarah. So let's go and talk with a caller. Our guest this afternoon is architect and designer Sarah Susanka. Her latest book is Home by Design: Transforming Your House into Home. She is also the author of The Not So Big House, and you'll find her on the internet at notsobighouse.com. Our first caller this afternoon, a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I did not design nor build my home, but I think I bought it for a lot of the same reasons that I hear you talking mm-hmm. about. It was built in 1913, mm-hmm. and one of the things I liked about it is the ceilings are like 9 feet tall, so it has a nice sense of mm-hmm. a space that way. But even though it's not a particularly large place, it's about 1,000 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
It has pocket doors, which are like 54 inches wide.
Yes, right.
So that, and they're French doors between the living room and dining room, so you can see from the front of the house all the way to the back of the house.
Right.
Which gives it a bigger sense of space.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also walk around, like, the living room into the bedroom, through the bathroom, into the other room that's an office, and then to the dining room.
So you get a good sense of flow to the house, it sounds like.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, there are other nice things, like the floors were laid out in picture framing style,
mm-hmm.
and the living room has the original stencil work.
Yeah,
still.
So there's lots of personal touches, it sounds like, but really some wonderful spatial qualities. You actually enumerated a couple that I talk about in this new book. I referred to interior views, and it sounds as though your house has a long view through. That's one of the applications that I talk about, and connecting views. Another one that is very common in smaller old homes like you're describing are diagonal views, so that you're looking from one corner all the way to the far opposite corner. So essentially, you're looking along the hypotenuse of the longest view that you can get within the house.
Yeah.
I don't know if yours does that or not, but it's...
No, it doesn't do that, but it does have a diagonal in one corner of the living room where they put a fireplace
mm-hmm.
there with ceramic tile around yeah. the firebox and mirror and double mantle and that sort
right.
of thing. That was
right.
in the bay window as well that
yeah.
gives the living room a little more sense
yeah.
of space.
Oftentimes the places that we like the best, and it sounds like your house probably exemplifies a lot of what I describe, they're just good design. It's just, and when you're in it, you don't even realize that there are these things that have been done by the original designer or architect to make you feel good. And so one of the things I've been told since my book was released in March is that people write to me and say, my house does these things, and now I understand why I like those spaces so well.
Yeah, I think about 5 minutes after I walked into it, I knew I was going to buy it.
Mm. Yep, well, I tell a very similar story about the first house that I built, I bought when I was looking for a place that felt good to be in, and it completely surprised me because this particular house, I didn't even know when I decided I wanted it whether or not it had half the features that I was thinking about. I didn't know how many bedrooms it had. I just knew it felt like home. And so one of my inspirations for writing this Home by Design was just to try to understand what is it that makes us feel that sense of this is it, this is home.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank
nice
you
to talk to
call.
You.
Let's talk with another listener, also in Champaign, line two. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I want to pay you a compliment. because when my husband and I discovered your first book and your philosophy, we felt sort of validated in the fact that we lived in a small house that was very multi-purpose, and we use our rooms lots of different ways. We're constantly moving things around, and we're very satisfied by that. And it's like, oh, that's already part of your philosophy.
Right, right.
And it's made it kind of okay, you know, not to live in a McMansion. And
I've heard that from a lot of people who just assumed that that's what you had to do next was buy a bigger house.
Yeah,
and, you know, just to find out that, oh, it's okay, I can stay in the place I feel comfortable in.
Right, and you can say to people, there's a philosophy, and there's people that do this, and it's okay, and, you know, all
that. That's right.
But one of the things that we're always grappling with is if we were ever going to do any building on to our house, which has such a flow that when our kids were little, they could literally tricycle through the entire house.
Right.
How does one go about finding architects who have a sympathetic view to that, so that aren't, you know, who look non-traditionally, kind of the way you do?
Well, I'm glad you asked the question, because when I wrote my first book, I realized that I was going to be telling everyone they needed an architect, and they were going to have a hard time finding them. So I actually started a directory of architects and builders, and actually all of the different professionals that you need to help you with building a not-so-big house. And you can go to the website and go to the Home Professionals Directory. So go to Not-So-Big House, Home Professionals Directory, and right there you can enter your location, and architects that work in your area will come up onto your screen.
Fantastic.
Just like anybody else, though, you need to check references. These aren't people who I have checked personally. They're simply people who ascribe to the same basic attitudes that I do, and have identified themselves as such, and are interested in helping. So there's a lot of architects out there. If that doesn't bear fruit for you, then call your local chapter of the American Institute of Architects. So it's AIA, American Institute of Architects, and they will also be able to help you with the architecture firms that do residential work.
Great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Best of
Bye.
Luck to you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Another listener in Champaign on line 3. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a woodworker and get involved in some design build situations.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of subscribe to a premise I'd heard many years ago, that the roof of a building defines its character.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered how you felt about that, and how one coordinates that sort of overarching exterior
right.
requirement with creating these different types of views and sight
sure.
lines and layers.
Well, you're talking about something that's actually very near and dear to my heart. I agree with you. I think that the roof gives a very, it's obviously the major shelter. It gives it's almost like an archetypal image of shelter. And so that roof, it's a what's often called a vernacular form. It's something that recalls our roots. And inside the house, you can either have the roof shape expressed, so you can see the vaulting ceiling, and I think that's partly why a lot of people like the idea of cathedral ceilings. But it's also very important to not only just follow the roof shape itself, but make some other shapes as well. So one of the things that I talk about in Home by Design is that through using ceiling height variety, you can bring some alternate shapes of ceiling in addition to the taller ceilinged areas. One of the things that I think people love about Cape Cods is that they express that shape of the roof in the second floor, and I think there you can really get a sense of intimacy and kind of coziness that a lot of people really enjoy, and that is the roof expressing itself. So how you tie the two together is really an art form. When architects design, they're often first of all thinking about the outside, and then they'll move to the inside and go back to the outside and inside. So there's a kind of informing that happens as you are designing. And I imagine as if you're a builder, you're very familiar with that notion that you can kind of flip between the inside and the outside. And if oftentimes if you're thinking about some floor plan ideas, then you'll check them out three-dimensionally and see how that will work in the roof. for people that aren't trained in architecture or building, it can be a real challenge, especially when people are thinking about adding on to a house, because the roof is where the answer lies. And oftentimes they're trying to solve it in the floor plan. You've got to figure out first, how do I make a roof that's going to work with the existing roof? And that's a secret that a lot of homeowners don't realize. So very valuable little piece of information. If for those listeners who are interested in that, by the way, in my book, Not So Big Solutions, there is quite a bit of information about how to look at adding on, starting from the roof and then working down.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Let's talk with another listener on the toll-free line in Charleston. Good afternoon.
Yes. I don't really know where to begin, and I can only use the example of my son, who had a one-story house, and then he built onto it with two floors. So it looks like two houses stuck together.
I know where you're going.
Yeah, so that's what occurred with him.
Right.
And then with myself, I built a home here in Charleston that I call it vernacular naive.
Great, I love it.
Since I didn't know what I was doing, I then was naive. But I got it together, and I love the Victorian.
Yes.
And that was the premise by which I started, and I never employed anyone except myself.
Sure.
And the house is small, 24 by 30, with a 24 by 22 two-car garage, which is lower than the main house, which is a story and a half.
Right. That's good. Incidentally, to interject for a second, that you can keep the garage smaller than the house, then you're getting the priorities right, that the important part is the house, not the place we keep our car.
Well, it just occurred to me that it would not look pleasant with a large garage. I did so under the east gable. And there are five gables on the house with two dormers. And the lower floor, the dining room, kitchen, are right across from each other. Then through the entryway, a 12 by...
I'm going to interrupt you for a second because our listeners are going to get lost here. There's a lot of specifics, but is there a particular... Are you happy with how it turned out?
Oh, I just love it. I never get tired looking at it.
That's fantastic.
And did it with the Victorian. I love the Victorian.
Right.
And usually those, the larger, the better. But this one being a small house, and I did all this by myself, it took me...
You probably learned a lot from just looking at existing houses and understanding the lessons to be learned from just how we've always done things. There's a lot of beautiful styles that people really are attracted to that have some amazing lessons to teach us if we just know what to look for. That's really what this Home by Design is about. I bet if you were to look at this book now, you'd find that you had done a whole bunch of things right on.
Right on. Being naive, I did in spite of myself. I got it right. Well, it was all from salvage. I bought very little new lumber. I got to a lot of old Victorians coming down.
That's a wonderful thing to do.
Yes,
gives materials some new life.
Yes, it did, and it never... I never let up. Whenever I had the opportunity, I salvaged the exterior elements and interior elements. It's just as ornate inside as it is outside, with a portalise on the west end.
You know what you're referring to, really, is that one of the things we also are very hesitant to do today is to personalize. And personalizing can come in all sorts of versions.
Yes.
And what you're describing is that you have a love of some of these old house parts. And you can make your house a very personal expression through the use of those. But you can do it in hundreds of other ways, too. The things that is too bad, I think, is that our focus today on resale and on worrying about whether somebody else is going to like exactly what we like has frightened us into not doing anything of a personal nature. And then, of course, you end up wanting to move because you don't have that quality that makes the place feel like you.
Well, the only way I'll leave this place is feet first.
Well, I'm really thrilled you've got such a great house. Congratulations.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. That's really nice to hear somebody who is really in love with their home.
Yes, absolutely.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Architect Sarah Susenka is our guest this afternoon. She's the author of The Not-So-Big House. That's how all of this got started. Her latest book is Home by Design, Transforming Your House into Home. You'll find her on the World Wide Web at notsobighouse.com. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the conversation this afternoon with your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. So why do we have all these big houses with where the front is dominated by the garage or garages? How did that happen?
It's a funny story, actually. And what happened to start with is that we ended up wanting more and more garages, not always to park cars, I might add. You know, oftentimes people have garages that are mostly for storage. But in order to span the distance from one side of a three-car garage to the other, we ended up creating these huge roofs made out of roof trusses. And until somebody stopped to think about it, that roof ended up being almost as tall or sometimes even taller than the main house. So for many years, we were building houses that really, you'd drive past them and go, now what's the most important thing in these people's lives? Their car. And that's not the message that we typically want to send to the street. We didn't realize that that's what we were doing. And one of the very hot topics of the last 10 years has been how to downplay the garage so that maybe either by tucking the garage around the side so you're not looking at the front doors, or if you do have to have the garage doors facing the street, to lower the roof of that area or break it up a little bit so that it's not such a dominant force. And if you can't do that, then at least make the garage doors themselves visually more interesting. So I actually describe in this book, in Home by Design, an idea of putting a pattern of woodwork over the garage door so that it just looks less garage door-y. And I call that simple pattern overlay. It's a simple way to make it look a little better.
I have seen homes where the garage is in the back, kind of borrowing from the alley idea, I think. Mm-hmm. And I like that, except then you've got a large concrete apron.
That's right.
In the back.
Yeah.
So that's, I don't know how you
well,
get
it. You know, with all of these things, there are ways to make them less obtrusive. And in fact, there are, in various different parts of the country, different solutions. When I lived in Oregon, one of the favorite products that was used in front of the garage door was a kind of concrete paver that allowed grass to grow up in between. So it just depends on where you are and what the local manufacturers will make. But there's ways of doing it.
Yeah. Well, there are some, I've seen in the neighborhood that I live in, some people have taken out the concrete and have put in stone.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Right.
Works pretty.
Yeah. The challenge always with all of these things is how to do beautifully something that doesn't break the bank in the process.
Right.
You know, that's always the trick. In fact, one of the things that I try to do with all of my books is to explain the idea behind the design so that whether or not you've got just a little bit of money to spend or a lot, you can find your way of doing it that's going to cost something that you can afford.
Yeah. Well, I live in a not-so-big house, and I love it. My problem is as you mentioned, public radio people, books. Lots of books and magazines and newspapers and stuff.
Right.
And, you know, over time, family members have given my husband and I things, and we love them. But we're in a position now where we have to do some editing.
Yeah.
Any advice for doing editing? And there's a wonderful show on cable TV called Sell This House, where they kind of stir things up.
Mm-hmm.
They edit and shuffle.
Yeah.
Some ideas here in general.
Well, there's a couple that I would give you. There was, actually, I started my first book, Not So Big House, with a quote from William Morris, who was one of the founders of the arts and crafts movement of the past century. And he said, basically, do not keep anything in your home that you do not know to be beautiful or find to be useful. And I think that's incredibly good advice, because if you can be inspired by something, that's worth keeping. You can find something useful, that's worth keeping. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of stuff that we collect over a lifetime mm-hmm. that, you know, we can probably think of a reason why we might need it someday, but if that someday hasn't happened for the last 10 years, it's probably safe to say it's not going to in the next 10 either.
Yeah.
And so it might be time to part with it.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating issue that we have. We are major accumulators of stuff in our culture, and that's certainly a very big reason why our houses get bigger. And some of it, you know, is fine, but I think there comes a point where you have to decide, do we really want to build another, say, 800 to 1,000 square feet to accommodate our stuff, or do we want to pare down? And that is really a question that often doesn't get asked. We just assume that the stuff needs
yeah,
a place.
Yeah.
So one of the things I really encourage people to do is just engage in some of this stuff more consciously, more, you know, be aware of what decisions we're making.
Yeah. One of the things that I really enjoy about your books is that there's always a clean look, but that doesn't mean sterile.
Right.
The space is warm and inviting, but it's not cluttered at all.
Right.
No clutter.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Indeed. And I think that's fine line between where things are pared down to such a degree that, gee, it looks pretty, but you might not want to live there. There's an awful lot of things purported to be good design that I would have a hard time living in, because I like to have my stuff around me.
Yeah.
But it's just how much of it, and where is it still enjoyable, and where does it become a burden?
Yeah. Let's see if we can get another call or two in here this afternoon. We're going to go to Charleston, toll-free line 4. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say, first of all, I think you are the smartest woman in architecture today.
Oh, thank you.
Your books make so much sense. I also was wondering what your feelings were about laundry rooms that are not near bedrooms,
mm-hmm.
and stairs that don't connect to kitchens, like the Fuller Brushman still comes to the door.
Well, I can certainly answer the laundry question. You know, I've worked with so many people over the course of my career, and everybody has a different attitude about where the laundry should go, and it really is based on our behavior patterns. So if you're somebody that likes to be, you know, maybe doing laundry at the same time that you're cooking dinner, then the laundry really does need to be close to the kitchen, because you're coming and going mostly from those two spaces. If you have to then run the laundry back up to the bedrooms if they're on a second level, that may be less onerous than if you had to do that running around while you were cooking the dinner. For other people, I've worked with people who, however good you are at logic, they still want the laundry in the basement. Believe it or not, after all these years, that's where they had it as a child, that's where their mom did the laundry, and that's where they want it. So it's funny to just see how, for some people, it's the patterns of behavior that they've lived with all their lives that tell you where the laundry should be. For others, it's more practical. And what you're referring to is laundry close to the bedrooms. That makes an awful lot of sense for people who maybe have a number of children and all the laundry gets generated upstairs. Why not have a laundry on that second level close to the bedroom so that where it's generated is where it gets washed?
I was wondering, though, also, have you been able to convince your other clients that dumbwaiters are not dumb?
That's a good question. It's funny, isn't it? We don't do many dumbwaiters anymore. You know, in fact, I bet you there's even some listeners that don't know what they are, but they're just a little tiny elevator that you move by hand that allows stuff to go up and down. It used to be used to bring food up from a lower level to an upper level when we had mm-hmm. Service staff in the house. But, you know, they are a very good idea, especially as we get older. rather than having to carry stuff up and downstairs, to have this little thing that you can just pull the cord and up it goes. It's fantastic.
Yeah. I wonder if we're going to, as we age and as the population becomes older, that our ideas about housing are going to change.
Actually in the process right now. There's a lot of discussion about that issue.
Yeah, because I know that, in my golden years, I don't want to be going from the basement with the laundry up to the second floor bedroom. I want to have it on the same level, and I want to have built-ins.
That's right.
You know?
Exactly. There's a whole movement that some of your listeners may be familiar with, universal design, which is really just looking at the common sense of how do you organize your decision-making today so that as you age, you can the house will really accommodate you. We can't predict everything that's going to happen, and nor should we even try, but there are some sensible things that we can do. For example, making doorways 2'10" wide so that should you ever need to get a wheelchair through that door, it can go. There's some stuff like that that's so basic.
And in the kitchen, too, I think I would go, if I was going to be able to do this myself, I would have varying levels of counter space.
Yeah.
So that whether, the house was could be comfortable for, children and could be comfortable for anybody in a wheelchair.
Right.
So that you could, just wheel right in.
Right.
Pull up your chair and do tasks there in the kitchen.
There's a real fine line too between where there's things that are sensible and where you can go overboard.
Yeah.
I've had clients before that have really, decided to do everything, make it wheelchair accessible, not yet in a wheelchair, and then have wished that maybe they hadn't done quite as much, but then decided to do that as a remodeling project if that were to occur. So there's you could spend a lot of money imagining futures. And I always try to tell people, do the sensible stuff. Certainly make a room on the main level that could be converted into a master bedroom in the future.
Mm.
But don't go overboard, because you can spend money that you really will never need to, just because you're trying to do the right thing. And we can get really lost in those decision-making processes.
Right. Sarah, thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. Well, it was delightful to chat, and you had great callers, too.
Sarah Susanka has been our guest this afternoon. Her latest book is Home by Design, Transforming Your House into Home. You'll find her on the web at notsobighouse.com. All her books are published by the Taunton Press. It's 7 minutes before 2 o'clock. Dave Dickey is standing by with prices from the Chicago Board of Trade.
Yes, I indeed am, Celeste, and it was a very, very difficult day on the Chicago Board of Trade. Soybean futures in particular took a sharply lower turn, particularly after the nearby contracts plummeted to limit down levels earlier in the day. They did manage to fight back somewhat, but once the July soybean contract breached that $9 level, the market crossed a threshold and the funds began to take a signal as a sell at that point. We'll get to those particulars in just a second. First, looking at the wheat. The July contract, a high on the day of 339.5, a low of 336.5, settling 338.5, down 2.75. September, a high of 348.5, a low of 345.5, settling 348, down 2. December, a high of 360, a low of 356.5, settling 359.25, down 2.5. March, a high of 370, a low of 366, settling 368, down 2. May, a high of 371.5, a low of 371, settling on the low, down a half on the day. July corn, a high of 273, a low of 270, settling 271.25, down 5. Crop weather declared excellent for corn over the next several weeks, and crop conditions are expected to improve this afternoon at 3 o'clock when the numbers are released by 1 or 2 percentage points. September, a high of 277, a low of 274, settling 275, down 5.5. December, a high of 281.5, a low of 277.5, settling 279, down 6.5. March, a high of 288, a low of 284.25, settling 285.5, down 5.5. May, a high of 293, a low of 289, settling 290.75, down 5.5. July, a high of 295, a low of 291.75, settling 292.25, down 4.5. July Oats, a high of 145, a low of 141, settling 143, down 2.75. September, a high of 151.5, a low of 147, settling 147.5, down 4.25. July soybeans, a high of 921.5, a low of 870.5, settling 885, down 35.5. August, a high of 845, a low of 796.75, settling 807.5, down 39.25. September, a high of 751, a low of 704, settling 722, down 26.5. November, a high of 712, a low of 671, settling 688.5, down 21. January, a high of 711, a low of 678, settling 690, down 21. March, a high of 709, a low of 674, settling 689, down 20 on the day. July soybean meal, a high of 307.70, a low of 289, settling 294, down $14. August, a high of 288.30, a low of 268.30, settling 273.30, down $15. July soybean oil, a high of 29.25, a low of 28.25, settling 28.52, down 72. August, a high of 28.37, a low of 27.30, settling 27.53, down 78 on the day. Settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and it was a tough day there as well, Celeste, as we see in the feeders, limit down after that announcement on Friday after the closing bell of the potential of another case of BSE in the U.S.
Right, mad cow disease. Let's take a look at what happened today on the Mercantile Exchange. Livestock prices: August feeder cattle, the high today 112 even, the low 111.15, the settlement 111.15, that down the limit, down $3. September feeder cattle, 110 the high, 109.35 the low, and the settlement, that down the limit. October feeder cattle, 107.85, the high 107.15, the low and the settlement, that down the limit. June live cattle, 88.70, the high 86.60, the low 87.10, the settlement, that down 250. July, 87 even, the high, that's the number across the board, that down 240. August live cattle, 87.90, the high 86.35, the low 86.42.5, the settlement, that down 292.5. July lean hog, 78.50, the high 76.15, the low 77.05, the settlement, that up 10. August, 77.10, the high 74.40, the low 75.52.5, the settlement, that up 17.5. October lean hog, 65.70, the high 64.20, the low 65.12.5, the settlement, that up 27.5. December lean hogs, 60.90, the high 59.55, the low 60.42.5, the settlement, that up 27.5. July bellies, 117, the high.